Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us. I hope you're well, your families are well, and your friends are well. My name is Leslie Dach. I'm the chair of Protect Our Care, which is an organization that was created to protect and improve America's healthcare. And this last week, we also launched the Coronavirus War Room as a project of Protect Our Care to specifically focus on this current healthcare crisis. Today, I'll make some very brief remarks, then turn it over to our speakers, and then we'll open up the line for questions. With us today is Senator Chris Murphy from the great state of Connecticut, who's both a fighter and a leader on healthcare in the U.S. Senate and for the people of Connecticut. Just this week, the senator announced the Medical Supply Chain Emergency Act, legislation that forced President Trump to implement the Defense Production Act of 1950 and to federalize the manufacturing and distribution of scarce in-demand medical supplies. While the administration has repeatedly told the American people that we are in good shape and that they have already begun their process, the fact is that no meaningful action has been taken, and the outcries from healthcare workers and from state and local government officials get stronger every day. His inaction has left hospital and healthcare workers and governors without the proper gear and forced to fight each other instead of taking advantage of this country's capability at the federal level. And so with that, let me hand it over to Senator Murphy, and then I'll introduce each speaker in turn. Senator?
Thank you very much, Leslie. Thank you, everyone, for joining this call. I'm grateful for all the leaders who are aligned today around a very simple concept. In the middle of a crisis of this size and scale, it is an abomination that the administration still allows our frontline healthcare workers to go unprotected. And that failure of the administration to make sure that we have the medical supplies necessary to confront this crisis is a gift to the virus and an invitation for it to continue to spread out of control. Let me give you a real-world example of how that occurs. Governor Lamont and I were together last night giving a joint briefing to reporters in Connecticut. At that briefing last night, Governor Lamont announced that today Connecticut would be scaling back testing, not ramping up testing. Protective equipment in Connecticut to cover both our drive-through testing sites and our patient hospital departments. So in Connecticut today, we are testing less people than we tested yesterday because of the lack of personal protective equipment. Now, very soon, we will also have a lack of tests in Connecticut. I talked to one of our busiest hospitals' CEOs 2 days ago. He told me that he had enough tests to last him 3 days, and his supplier just called and told him that the next shipment would not be made. And so one of our busiest hospitals in Connecticut may not have enough tests this weekend. It is time for the president to stop whining and tweeting and start acting. The president complained this morning about GM's apparent reversal on the number of ventilators they were going to produce. Well, it doesn't have to be up to GM. The President of the United States has the power to require manufacturers to produce ventilators and personal protective equipment and tests, and then to make sure that that equipment gets to the right place. Today, we are in a Lord of the Flies environment in which every single hospital and every single state is competing with each other for scarce medical. And so even if we were able to double the amount that we were making today, we still wouldn't be assured that those supplies would get to the people, the healthcare professionals, and the parts of the country that need it the most. So the Medical Supply Chain Emergency Act, introduced by myself, Senator Schatz in the Senate, Tim Ryan and Melissa Slotkin in the House, would not only require the president to operationalize the Defense Production Act, but also require him to take temporary control of the supply chain of critical medical equipment to make sure that those ventilators and those masks and those tests are getting to the places that need it. Right now, our states and our hospitals are having to bid against each other and chase down leads and pull political strings in order to get equipment. The private market is breaking down right now, and the president needs to start acting like the president. Tweeting and complaining doesn't help anybody right now. Congress has given him the power, has given the administration the power to fix what is so broken about the medical supply chain. And as we are seeing in Connecticut, the consequences of not having enough equipment are that the virus continues to spread. What happens in Connecticut today is that less people will get tested, and so less people will know that they are positive. They will continue to interact with others in their community, and the virus will spread. We can't beat this virus unless we get serious about fixing the supply chain. It's time for either Congress to pass this legislation or for the president to do it himself. Leslie, thank you for having us on this call. I know Mary Kay Henry is going to follow me. Thank you to Organized Labor for continually standing up for workers. She's been an incredibly strong voice on behalf of making sure that not just her members, but every single frontline worker in this country has the protection that they need.
Thank you, Senator, and it's outrageous that states are having to cut back on their testing because of these issues. Mary Kay Henry is the international president of the 2 million member Service Employees International Union, which is also the largest healthcare union in North America with over 1.1 million members who serve and care for 60 million patients, not only in 29 states, but also in two countries. And as all of us know who've been in this fight, there's no better ally to have in any fight than SEIU and Mary Kay Henry. With that, Mary Kay, we'd love to hear your perspective.
Thank you so much, Leslie. I'm proud to stand with you and Zach and the Protect Our Care team and with the Senator Murphy, who we see as our champion in making a breakthrough on getting the federal government to do its job. And for the heroine of the moment, our frontline healthcare worker, Brianna, who we will hear from shortly. I join you all on behalf of the 2 million members of SEIU who have the backs of the 10 million healthcare workers on the front lines of this pandemic in home care settings, skilled nursing facility settings, hospitals and clinics all across this country. We are on the front lines of this crisis and are joining with Senator Murphy in calling on the federal government to do its job and get the Trump administration to do the right thing. SEIU healthcare workers are calling for two things. The federal government has to drive a coordinated national response to get more supplies and equipment to frontline caregivers. And just behind that need is the need for the federal government to coordinate the expanded bed capacity that's going to be required as the pandemic surges. And behind that need is going to be the need for a reserve healthcare workforce that is ready, willing, and able to step in as the surge occurs across this country. Everyone who is providing treatment to people and who are infected is now putting their own health at risk. The second thing the federal government has to do is give the tools of care to every provider and has to protect each and every caregiver with paid sick, paid leave, and paid health care. I know it's hard to believe, but that is not a standard for the 10 million healthcare workers in this country. Nurses, doctors, home care, and nursing home workers shouldn't be left on their own. It is outrageous that states are being forced to outbid each other for supplies for healthcare workers, and it's not enough that individual companies are contributing masks and equipment or that neighborhood listservs are putting masks on their doorsteps, I heard, and letting healthcare workers pick them up on their way to work. It's crazy that people are being asked to make their own masks. A national emergency deserves a national coordinated response. And one of our local unions in California was so desperate, they went on their own trying to chase supplies and secured 39 million critically needed N95 masks. But even that local union understands how absurd it is that they're put in the position of trying to respond to their members' outcries by trying to get in a supply chain business that is not our core competency. We need the federal government to do its job. Our members have to step in because of this abdication of federal leadership, and that shouldn't be put on the shoulders of providers who are already carrying the anxiety of their own health, their family's health, and the patients that they serve. The pandemic is expanding every day before our eyes, and there is no one besides the federal government who has the ability to inventory the need across state lines, to get every provider to be safe, and to convert manufacturing with the rapidity that we're going to need to meet the surge. We are denying healthcare workers necessary protective equipment at the same time they're being denied sick leave in this crisis. It's immoral and it's outrageous. And that's why we're demanding paid sick and paid leave, prioritizing people above corporations, and ensuring everyone can obtain free testing and treatment, including immigrants. I want to thank you for your time, and I'm proud to stand with Brianna and all of you in making this demand of the federal government to do its job.
Thank you, Mary Kay, and it's just even hard to listen to that.
Yes.
Add one word before I turn it over to our next speaker. When I was the senior counselor in the HHS secretary in the last administration, I was given the task of being the global Ebola coordinator for that department, and spent over a year in daily meetings. And it just outrages me, having sat in the Situation Room day after day, having sat at HHS, to know that really this was preventable. The situation that we're in today in terms of supplies and hospitals and workers. It just took foresight and work. And unfortunately, we had a president who, even from before the virus emerged, refused to take these issues seriously, repeatedly tried to slash the CDC budget, eliminated and disbanded the pandemic operation at the NSC that had learned all the lessons of the Ebola outbreak, who continues to refuse to listen to the experts and wasted months downplaying the severity of the crisis and simply making statements that instead of informing the public, confuse them. We've even allowed this country to fall behind other countries like South Korea, where the virus is receding, and still the president refuses to listen to the experts like those here on this call or those who are saying that this is no time to cut back on prevention. But instead, we continue to see the same pattern of a president who doesn't learn from their mistakes, and America pays the price. Let me turn to Katrina Mulligan, who's the Managing Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Previously, she served as an attorney advisor and the Director of Preparedness and Response in the National Security Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Katrina?
Yes, I'm glad to be here. So I wanted to just do three quick things. One is talk a little bit about what the Defense Production Act could actually empower the president to do if he were using it fully. Then I want to talk about who's opposing this and why the president may not be choosing to exercise this authority, because I think it reveals quite a bit. And then I want to just quickly touch on some immediate things that you would want to see the government doing if we were actually utilizing this authority the way we could be. So starting with just what the DPA actually is, the Defense Production Act is a powerful way for the president to leverage domestic manufacturing capacity for national emergencies. And there are three key provisions that are relevant to the crisis that we're currently facing. The first one is that the Defense Production Act gives the president the power to demand that manufacturers prioritize and fill government orders first for essential goods. In other words, they can cut in line to demand that the orders be filled for the government first before any other orders or contracts are filled. That's important because in the absence of action, using the DPA, nothing is stopping manufacturers today from filling existing orders, including orders that may be overseas, where those orders were placed before the demand spiked here inside the United States. And so it's really important that the president exercise the authority to cut in line and ensure that what our domestic capacity is producing is actually making its way to the U.S. Hospital systems and health workers that need it. Second, the Defense Production Act allows the president to prevent hoarding of essential goods and attempts to sell those goods above their fair market value, a practice commonly known as price gouging. If the president uses this authority, companies can still make a fair profit, but what they can't do is withhold goods, drive up the price, and sell to the highest bidder. We're already anecdotally hearing a lot of evidence that this is happening as states compete against each other and hospital systems compete against each other for scarce goods. And it's also worth pointing out that the manufacturers are not the ones who should be making life or death decisions about who receives goods and when. That those decisions really need to be made by the federal government, by accountable public officials, and with the ability to leverage a lot of information about where the crisis is the most extreme and who needs what when. And then third, the Defense Production Act allows the president to provide incentives, including even equipment, to domestic manufacturers to encourage them to increase their production. These include things like purchase guarantees and subsidies and other types of commitments that the federal government can make to give manufacturers some sense that if they make those changes, it will remain profitable for them to do so. So in short, the president can leverage this tool rather powerfully and immediately to transform production to meet the national need. So the next question is, so why isn't he using it, and who's against it? The most obvious group of people who are opposing the use of the Defense Production Act are the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and manufacturers themselves, who really don't want the federal government interfering with what is a high profit time for them. And I think that some of very important questions, particularly for the reporters on the call, need to be asked about who's whispering in the president's ear and urging him to not leverage this tool, because usually we've seen that where he has the ability to order people to do something, he tends to like to do that. And in this case, he's not. And I think it's because industry is urging him not to, and that is not the right instinct. So then the third point here, how should the DPA be used, and what would you expect to see if we were fully utilizing this tool? The first thing we would want to see is the Trump administration immediately generate manufacturing orders. All of the tweets about I'm invoking the DPA or I'm, none of tweets do not cause the Defense Production Act to become self-executing. In the absence of actual orders, the Defense Production Act isn't being used. And so I think there needs to be an immediate and transparent placement of federal orders with clear timetables for production and some sense of where how the logistics is going to work. Second, the Trump administration needs to organize itself to manage the logistical task, which is going to be incredibly immense. And third, they need better and more transparent data about what's going on in hospitals and localities across the country. I mean, just today, the New York Times released some very impressive data sets to the public. I have a lot of questions about why private entities and not the federal government are releasing those kinds of data sets. We need to be making data-informed and data-driven decisions right now, and it does not appear like that is happening. So with that, I'll turn it back to you guys, and happy to answer questions at the end.
Thanks, Katrina. Brianna Bernini is an emergency department tech at Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, and an executive board member of SEIU Healthcare, Minnesota. Unfortunately, she's able to talk from firsthand experience about what it means to be on the ground as a healthcare worker in this crisis and about the vivid need for equipment that healthcare workers are unable to receive. Just in her own experience recently, she was given a mask and told that it was her only mask of the day. And so she was asked and did work 6 hours. And in every room she went into, there was a patient who might have had the coronavirus. But she was asked and did take a used mask from room to room, exposing herself and possibly patients because of the lack of equipment availability. And to think that in this, the greatest economy in the world, we are facing this situation is really beyond the imagination. So, Brianna, thank you for all you do and continue to do, and thanks for being on the call today.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me. What you were just talking about is what we are truly experiencing. I worked yesterday, just a six-hour shift, and at the beginning of our shift, we were told we have one face shield to use, and then we would throw it away at the end of our shift, and then the next day we'd get a new one. By the middle of our shift, we were told that for the foreseeable future, we have to keep that shield safe because that is what we have to use. We don't have any other shields coming to our hospital. And I worked in a pod that was specifically for rule-outs of COVID. But we are also not testing any patients because we don't have any tests. So we're assuming that everyone has it. And between each, when you go into a room, you gown up, you have to go through a series of steps. You go in, and then the goal with PPE is to take all that stuff off and clean, you know, throw it away or, you know, dispose of it. But we are having to step out of the room and then cleaning these items and then going into the next room, not knowing if we are subjecting the next patient to possible corona. We have been told a number of different things when it comes to how to protect ourselves against this. Originally, the CDC and the administration had said that this was airborne and that N95s were what we needed to wear. Soon after that was said, that we could go to just regular surgical masks and the N95s were not needed. Well, now, you know, that on the CDC's website, it says, no, N95s, once we get more of them, then we'll go back to having you use them. And this is after, you know, we've been using the surgical masks. It's scary. I'm scared to death to go to work every day and come home, bring it possibly to my, I have elderly parents who both have medical issues. I don't want to bring it home to my husband. I have actually a coworker, one of the RNs I work with. She, yesterday after we found out that we had to use, reuse this mask for the, or the shield, what we call it, for the foreseeable future, she went on and ended up buying like a welding mask because she's so scared that she's going to bring this home to her kids. It's real. This is not a joke. I am living it every day. I normally do 12-hour shifts. So I have the possibility of encountering many coronavirus patients throughout my shifts. And if we as the frontline workers get sick, there is nobody to replace us. And if we, then that means when you get sick or your family members get sick, who's going to be able to take care of them? So thank you for, you know, letting me speak. I just wanted to let you know that this is real life. It's really scary. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for all you do and for sharing this. It's you know, just painful to listen to and to think that we're in this shape and the president, instead of taking us forward, seems to be intent on somewhere between doing nothing and taking us backwards. So now to our final speaker, Zach McCanus, who's a veteran strategist, campaigner, and organizer, and who is the executive director of the Coronavirus War Room. Zach.
Thank you so much, Leslie, and thank you for the leadership of Senator Murphy and Mary Kay Henry and Katrina. But I especially want to thank Brianne, who is truly an American hero, putting herself on the line to make sure that we get through this safely. So thank you so much. I want to sort of close this out by hanging a lantern quickly on an issue that many folks are talking about today, specifically the horror of the ventilator shortage crisis. that hospitals are facing across the country. There are reports all across the country of hospitals that are preparing to ration ventilators. New York doctors, they're looking to split ventilators between patients. One was quoted this morning as saying that it's, quote, suboptimal, but the other option is death, unquote. These stories, they're becoming more and more frequent. They're going to increase over time. I just think it's really important to be clear about why we are seeing this shortage. This is a direct result of the president's failure to prepare our nation and for the paralysis of this administration since the virus struck. From the very beginning, Trump ignored the warnings of experts, and he failed to put together a process in place to secure enough personal protective equipment for healthcare workers and for ventilators for sick patients. He could have invoked the Defense Production Act back in February, but instead, the president wasted precious months downplaying the severity of the crisis and making false statements that confuse the public. And what's really concerning is that he's still doing it. He's doing it today. He hasn't learned his lesson. Instead of committing to use his authority to harness America's industrial strength to meet the moment, he was on Fox News last night, where he directly contradicted public health officials when he said, quote, I don't believe you need 40,000 or 30,000 ventilators, unquote. And he said, quote, a lot of equipment is being asked for that I don't think they will need, unquote. You know, as Senator Murphy mentioned, Trump just angry tweeted at General Motors demanding that they make ventilators. But just yesterday, it was reported that the administration was scrapping an agreement for General Motors and Ventec Life Systems to produce as many as 80,000 ventilators, about 20,000 a month. It was reported that he was thinking that that's too many ventilators, that we don't need that many. But that's just simply not what the experts are saying. A Society of Critical Care report noted that the United States currently has between 160,000 and 200,000 ventilators, but could need as many as 1 million over the course of the outbreak. And the New England Journal of Medicine warned that there may be as many as 31 patients in need of ventilation per ventilator available in the United States. And that's not all we're hearing from the ground. As Brianna said, you know, healthcare workers are using bandanas and scarves to protect themselves because there aren't enough masks. It's being reported that hospitals are considering do not resuscitate orders for coronavirus patients because there's just not enough masks and gloves to protect doctors and nurses. This is the result of Donald Trump's refusal to take actions like invoking the Defense Production Act. And so the message today is that Donald Trump must recognize that this is an emergency, that people are dying, and that the time for misinformation is over, the time for inaction is over, and the time to invoke the Defense Production Act was actually several months ago, but it certainly is time right now. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Zach. Well, thanks to everyone. And Whitney, we want to open it up to see if there are any questions.
Yeah. At this time, if there's any questions for our speakers, if you press star 3 on your phone to enter our Q&A queue, again, that's star 3. All right, it doesn't look like we have any questions for today. Did you have some final closing remarks, Leslie?
No, I just want to thank the speakers again for taking their time, more importantly, for what they do every day, and hope that all of, you know, the actions of the people on this phone will actually lead to the changes in the White House that this country deserves. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe.